Hello. I don't think so. How do
Welcome, everybody. We're going to get started. So this year, we've really had the tremendous privilege of tapping into a lot of our local talent. So in that vein, I'd like to introduce Mrs. Cheryl Epstein, who really needs no introduction. She has been in our community for quite some time. She's been assistant principal at TA Girls High School, and has been teaching there and is a much beloved history teacher there for the past 20 years. She did her undergraduate work at Harvard and has a master's degree from Columbia and is also a consultant for teacher training at the Auerbach Central Agency for Jewish Education. We're very, very pleased that she's agreed to speak for us. Welcome, Cheryl.
Thank you. Good morning. Is there a microphone or isn't there, Tal? Okay, so I'm going to try very hard to project, and if you don't hear me, just raise your hand in the back, and I'll try to talk louder. I want to begin by expressing my hakar satov to Tal and to Orit and to Yoni for all of the time and the energy that they invest in this Midrashet Yom Rishon program, and for their dedication to bringing Torah learning to the women of our community on a regular basis. We are all very much in your debt. I would like to dedicate the learning today, Le'ilui Nishmas Avi Mori, Binyamin Meir Ben Dov Yitzchak, whose yahrzeit was on Rosh Chodesh Adar. I thought we would try to hold on just a little bit longer to the spirit of Purim, since we are still in Chodesh Adar. And I don't know about you, but I would rather look back to Purim, then look ahead to what's coming next. So we'll call it in Yanei Diyoma, even though it's a little bit past the Zman. I thought that we would take a look at the whole inyan of the war between Amalek and Klal Yisrael and try to understand more deeply what that's about and what it represents and what we can learn from it. So if you go to your source sheets on Source 1 and 2, let's just look closely at the two texts in Chumash that deal with the incident of the attack by Amalek on Bnei Israel in the Midbar. And I'll just read them in the Hebrew, and those of you who need the English can follow along. Vayavo Amalek. Sorry, I need my glasses to do this. ויבוא המלך וילחם עם ישראל ברפידים, ויומר משה לישוע בחר לנו אנשים וצא הילחם באמלק. מחר אנוכי ניצב על ראש הגבעה ומטה הלוקים בידי. ויעש יהושע כאשר אמר לו משה להילחם באמלק, ומשה, אהרון וחור עלו ראש הגבעה. והיה כאשר ירים משה ידו וגבר ישראל, וכאשר יניח ידו וגבר אמלק. וידי משה כבדים, ויקחו אבן וישימו תחתיו וישב עליה, ואהרון וחור תמכו בידיו. מזה אחד ומזה אחד, והיא ידיו אמונה עד בו השמש. ויחלוש יהושע את עמלק ואת עמו לפי חרב. ויאמר השם אל משה, כתוב זאת זיכרון בספר ושים באוזני יהושע, כי מחור אמחה את זכר עמלק מתחת השמיים. ויבן משה מזבח ויקרא שמו השם ניסי. ויאמר כי יד על כסקה מלחמה לשם בעמלק מדור דור. So what we have here is an account that really tells us nothing about Amalek at all. What it focuses on is the story of the battle that took place after Amalek attacked. All it tells us about Amalek is that they came and they attacked in a place called Rephidim. And then it tells us the whole story of the battle, which we'll go into in more detail in a little while. And at the end, Bnei Israel are triumphant. They win the war. Yehoshua weakens Amalek. And Hashem tells Moshe to tell Yehoshua and to write down for posterity that Hashem vows to wipe out the memory of Amalek from beneath the heavens. And Moshe builds a mizbeach and calls it Hashem is my miracle. If we then go to the next incident in the Chumash that deals with this same event, it's at the end of, the first one was at the very end of Parshas Bishalach. The next one is at the very end of Parshas Kitetze. And this one is the one that we read as Parshat Zachor the week before, the Shabbos before Purim. Zachor et asher asa lecha Amalek b'derech b'tzeitchem mimitzrayim, asher kocha b'derech v'yizanev b'cha kol hanechashalim acharecha, v'ata ayef v'yageh v'lo yirei elokim. והיה בהניח השם אלוקיך לך מכל אויביך מסביב בארץ אשר השם אלוקיך נותן לך נחלה לרשתה, תמחה את זכר עמלק מתחת השמיים לא תשכח. We have a totally different account here. Here it tells us nothing at all about the nature of the war that was fought, about the battle itself, but it gives us a much richer description of Amalek. And what emerges is a picture of a nation that is cruel. And they attacked with no provocation, with no warning. They attack from the rear. They attack the weak stragglers behind. They attack at a time when Bnei Israel are feeble and weary from their journey. And the punchline is that here, the Bnei Israel are told that when the time comes that you are settled in your own land that Hashem has promised to you as an eternal nachala, and you've taken care of all of your other enemies, there is a commandment that you must wipe out, you must eradicate the memory of Amalek, do not forget. So in the first, in Bishalach, it's Hashem who vows to wipe out Amalek. In Kitetze, it's Klal Yisrael who are given the commandment to wipe out Amalek. And then we have, at the very end of the description in Bishalach, we have this rather enigmatic pasuk, Vayomer ki yad al keska milchama l'Hashem ba'amalek midor dor. What does that mean? So the Ramban, and this is source number 3 on your source sheet, if you look at the first underlined section, umahu kes v'lo ne'amar kisei. Why does it say case and it's missing an aleph? It should say kisei, the throne of Hashem. Ve'af Hashem nechlak lechetzio. If you look at the Shem Hashem in that pasuk, there's a hyphen between the yud and the k. So why is Hashem's name split? Nishba hakadosh baruch hu she'en hakisei shalem ve'en Hashem malei ad shimach shmo shel Amalek. Because Hashem himself, kavyachol, has vowed that his throne, his kiseh hakavod, will not be complete, nor will his name be complete until the name of Amalek is wiped out from the world. very enigmatic pasuk. Even the Rambam, the Ramban's explanation is not particularly comprehensible to us. What does that really mean? We don't really know. But what we're left with is an impression that there is something in the nature of Amalek that is antithetical, so antithetical to godliness, that the two cannot coexist in the world. If we look at the question of why is it that Amalek attacked, perhaps it will give us a deeper understanding of the nature of the evil that seems to be embodied in Amalek. So let's go back to the Ramban, but this time to the last underlined section at the end. And the Ramban asks the following question: V'tam ha'onesh she'na'anash Amalek yoter mikol ha'amim. What is the reason that Amalek was punished so harshly, worse than any other nation? It's not apparent in the text what they did that was so egregious as to merit being blotted out from history. Ba'avur ki kol ha'amim sham uvu yergazun upileshet Edom u'Moav yoshvei K'nan namogu mipnei pachad Hashem u'mihadar ga'umo. Because, and here he's quoting from the Shira that was at the beginning of Parshas Beshalach after Kriyas Yamsuf, the reason is that all of the other nations, when they witnessed the miracles that Hashem did on behalf of Klal Yisrael and the things that he visited upon the Mitzrim and the miracle of Kriyas Yamsuf, all of the other nations of the ancient world trembled and melted away in terror before the Eternal God and the glory of His Majesty. The Amalek bavi merchak kemitgaber al Hashem, but Amalek came from far in order to challenge God, in order to make himself master over God. Ulechach amar bo v'lo yirei Elokim, and therefore the pasuk says of him, he had no fear of God. Rashi, in source number 4, focuses on the lashon of the pasuk in Kitetze, Zachor Asher Asalcha Amalek Baderch Betzaitchem Mitzrayim Asher Karcha Baderch. Asher Karcha Baderch. What does that word mean? It's an unusual word. Asher Karcha Baderch, Rashi says, one possibility is Lashon Mikre. It just was a chance occurrence. They happened upon Bnei Israel and they attacked. Then he offers another explanation. Go to the next area that's underlined. And he says, Lishon kor vachom. Perhaps it comes, korcha comes from the root of kor, of cold. And he says, perhaps what happened was that Amalek came with the intention of cooling off the sense of awe that the nations of the world had for Hashem in the wake of all of the miracles of Yitziat Mitzrayim. And he gives the analogy of a bathtub full of boiling water, and everybody's afraid to go into it because they'll get burned. And along comes one person and jumps all the way in, and he does get burned. But in the process, he cools it off for other people and makes it less terrifying. And that, he says, is analogous to what Amalek did when they came to attack Bnei Israel. All of the other nations of the world were too afraid of Hashem to do that. And Amalek came and showed, and came to show, that was his purpose, that Hashem really does not have control and Hashem cannot protect this people from being attacked. The Malbim on this inyan points out that none of the conventional reasons that motivate nations to go to war against other nations were operative in the case of Amalek. For example, we know that nations go to war for conquest, or they go to war preemptively when they're threatened. But Bnei Israel had not provoked Amalek at all, and they were simply wandering in the desert. They had no territory of their own to be conquered. So the Malbim says the only plausible reason, if you go down in the Malbim in source 5, three lines from the bottom of where it's underlined, V'rak hasibah ha'atzmait le'milchama zu haita, there's only one plausible explanation for this attack, mitzad ha'kfira be'elokim. Amalek came in order to rebel against God. That's the only plausible explanation. Amalek wanted to demonstrate to a world that was awed by God's miracles that there really were no miracles. That everything that had appeared to be so miraculous was really chance, coincidence, magic perhaps, kishuv, but not miracle. And therefore, says the Ramban, says the Malbim in the last little piece of a line that's underlined, ulefi zeh haya ikar milchamto neged Hashem. And therefore, the real purpose of Amalek's attack was not to declare war on the Jewish people so much as it was to declare war on God himself. Now I think we can better understand why the destruction of Amalek is phrased differently in Bishalach and in Ki Teitze. In Ki Teitze, the emphasis was on Amalek's conduct towards Bnei Israel, on their barbarity, on their cruelty, on their inhumanity to their fellow man. And for this, they merited punishment, and it's Klal Yisrael who were the victims of their cruelty, who have the obligation to stand up and to correct it, to address it, to do something about it. Where the account in Bishalach focuses more on the underlying motivation, that Amalek's war represented an attack on Hashem himself, an attack on the very essence of godliness. And therefore, it is Hashem, Kavyachol, who declares war and vows to eradicate Amalek. If we look more deeply at the placement in the Chumash of Amalek's attack, it will offer us more clues as to what Amalek represents, and perhaps will also help us to understand why it was that Bnei Israel were vulnerable to attack at this precise moment in time. The description of Amalek's attack in Parshas Bishalach is preceded by the incident of Masa Umariva, and I copied that incident for you from Parshas Bishalach in source number 6, but in the interest of time, I think I'll just summarize what happened. Bnei Israel are encamped in Rephidim, and they cry out that there's no water for them. They're thirsty. There's a tremendous discussion in the Mefarshim about, is that really the case? Was there really no water? Were they really thirsty? Or were they simply worried about running out of water in the future? Be that as it may, what the text tells us, the pshat, is that there wasn't water for them, and they cry out to Moshe, and they complain that he should give them water. And Moshe responds to them, why are you arguing with me? And why are you challenging God? And this is not the first time in the Parsha that we have seen Bnei Israel seem to lose faith in Hashem. The Parsha began with Kriyas Yamsuf and the incredible, glorious miracles of Yetzias Mitzrayim and the Shira. And very shortly after that, what do we find? Bnei Israel are complaining about the bitter water at Marah. Then they're complaining when they enter Midbar Sin that they're panicked about where they're going to find food. And Hashem responds by sending them the man. And now, as they arrive in Rephidim, once again they're arguing with Moshe and challenging Hashem. The Gemara, and the source here is number 7, Gemara Sanhedrin, asks the question, Mai Lishon Rephidim? What is that name, Rephidim? What is it? Where is it? What does it signify? Rabbi Yoshua Omer Sherifu Atzman Midivrei Torah. The name itself is symbolic. Rifu Atzman Min HaTorah. Their connection to Hashem's Torah was weakened at Rephidim. And that's why they became vulnerable to attack. Rav Shimon Schwab in Mayan Beis HaShoeva interprets this as a crisis of faith on the part of the people. They challenged Moshe. If we go back to source number 6, the very last pasuk there, Vayikra Shem HaMakom Masa Umeriva, Moshe called the place Masa Umeriva, Al Riv Bnei Israel Va'al Nasotam Et Hashem Leimor, on the infighting among Bnei Israel and on their challenge to Hashem, saying, the people said, Hayesh Hashem Bekirbenu Im Ein. Is Hashem in our midst or not? The Kli Yakar, if you look at source number 8, and again, I think I'll just paraphrase rather than take the time to go through the inside, but anybody who wants to, the source is here. The Kli Yakar attributes Bnei Israel's vulnerability to the fact that they became distanced not only from Hashem, but also from each other. He says that as long as Bnei Israel were faithful to Hashem and united with each other, Amalek had no opening in which to attack them. Amalek could not threaten them. But when Amalek heard about the quarreling at Masa Umeriva, where they found that there was strife among the people and the people were losing faith in God, That's when they found an opening and were able to do battle with Hashem. And he says, if you look at the, it's in the middle, ובעבור זה יוכל להילחם בהם, he could fight them, כי אז רפו ידיהם מכל וכל, because they were weakened in every respect, כי אין להם הצלה על צד הנס, שהיה שר השם מעליהם. They couldn't expect salvation through miraculous means, because Hashem had withdrawn from them, because they lost faith in him. וגם אין להם הצלה טבעית, שאיש את רעהו יעזורו. They also could not hope for salvation through natural means in which one person helps another. שהרי חלק ליבם זה מזה, because their hearts had become separated from each other. So they were very vulnerable. They could not count on Hashem saving them. They could not count on victory through natural means. And then he ends that section by saying, כי רפידים אותיות פרידים ואותיות רף ידיים. Refidim is a fascinating word. It contains within it the words, the same letters as the word predim, meaning disunited, separated, and the words raf yadayim, weakened. So it contains a symbol, a signal to us both of their distancing from Hashem and their distancing from each other. So the obvious question is, how could Bnei Israel have doubted whether Hashem was in their midst? How's that possible? All of the nations of the world other than Amalek trembled at the display of Hashem's glory and the miracles of Yetzias Mitzrayim. But Bnei Israel, who were the direct beneficiaries of those miracles, doubted Hashem's presence? How could that be? So the Netziv in his parish on Chumash, Hemek Davar, explains that of course they recognized that Hashem was with them. And I apologize that the Hemek Davar is the one source that I did not include here because it's extremely lengthy. But if anybody's interested in looking, it's the Hemek Davar on this section in Bishalach. The Hemek Davar explains that of course they recognized that Hashem was with them, but they were painfully and terrifyingly aware that their only experience of Hashem had been through a supernatural reality in which they were the constant beneficiaries of revealed miracles. Now, one might think that living in a supernatural reality like that, in which your every need is immediately and miraculously fulfilled, would be the greatest source of security. But in fact, the Netziv says quite the contrary. He says that it was a source of tremendous anxiety to them, because they knew that the miracles came from Hashem, and they knew that those miracles had nothing to do with their own merit. No person, most people, are not so meritorious as to deserve to live in such a miraculous kind of supernatural state. And so they were constantly worried, excuse me, about what would happen to them if and when that miraculous bubble would burst. And furthermore, they knew that Moshe Rabbeinu was their intermediary. He was the one through whom most of these miracles were effected. And they did realize that Moshe Rabbeinu was a truly godly man. And if anybody had the merit to deserve these kinds of miracles, it was Moshe Rabbeinu. But Moshe Rabbeinu was also a human being, and so they worried all the time about what was going to happen to them when Moshe Rabbeinu was gone. How would they survive once they were settled in the promised land and they had to live according to the natural order, al piteva? Would Hashem's protection and guiding hand still be with them? And how would they know whether Hashem was in their midst if they were no longer witnessing revealed miracles? This was the nature of their crisis of faith. It had to do with the question of divine providence in the real world, the world of teva. And of course, that is why they became vulnerable to Amalek, because Amalek represents the denial of divine providence in the real world. Amalek represents the idea that everything that happens in the world is a matter of chance, a matter of coincidence, of luck. Everything is random, and therefore everything is essentially devoid of meaning. And that's why, for Amalek, the only true value and the only security comes from power and might. I think the Netziv's analysis helps to clarify the Torah's description of the battle itself in Beshalach. Why did Moshe appoint Yehoshua to lead the battle rather than leading it himself? And what is this drama on the hilltop with Moshe's hands being raised and lowered? The Netziv explains that Moshe wanted to show B'nai Israel that Hashgachat Hashem, divine providence, exists even in the natural world where we can't see it. So he was determined to fight this battle against Amalek without overt miracles. Yehoshua was designated to lead the battle rather than Moshe, because to B'nai Israel, Moshe symbolized Hashem's working through supernatural means. And brilliant teacher and Rebbe that he was, Moshe Rabbeinu understood that this was a teachable moment. And he orchestrated the war so that it would be an opportunity for B'nai Israel to learn experientially how a people of faith conducts itself in the natural world. So Moshe instructs Yehoshua to select men as warriors. And if you look, he says, "Bechar lanu anashim v'tzehi lachem ba'amalek." Choose men for us and go out and fight with Amalek. Rashi in Source 9 says, "Bechar lanu anashim." What does that mean? "Giborim v'yirei chet shetehei zchutan m'saitan." Choose powerful men. Choose legitimate warriors in the normal, conventional, natural world sense of the word. But have them also be men who are God-fearing, so that their merits will stand them in good stead. Then he tells them they should prepare for war the next day. Why the delay? Why not go to battle right now? In order to give the men, the warriors, time to do tshuva before they go out to war. Meanwhile, Moshe vacates the battlefield, and together with Aaron and Hur, he stations himself on a hilltop where he can be seen by B'nai Israel. Chazal say that the three tzaddikim, Moshe, Aaron, and Hur, fasted and davened as the battle raged below. Moshe reassures Yehoshua, "I'm going to take with me my mateh, my miraculous rod through which all of the supernatural miracles occurred." But we find in the text he doesn't use it, because this is a war that must be fought without recourse to supernatural means. This is a war in which Hashem's guiding hand is hidden. This is B'nai Israel's first encounter with the concept of Hester Panim, with the concept of Hashem turning his face and operating kavyachol behind a veil. Wait a minute. What about Moshe's hands? Doesn't the Torah tell us that when Moshe raises his hands, they prevail, and when Moshe's hands go down, Amalek prevails? Isn't that a miracle? So the Gemara, Source 10 here in Rosh Hashanah, asks exactly that question. V'hayak hasher yarim Moshe yado v'gavar Yisrael v'gomer. V'chi yadav shel Moshe osot milchama o shavrot milchama? Is it Moshe's hands that determine the outcome of the war? Ela lomar lecha, kol zman shehayu Yisrael mistaklin klapei mala, u'meshabdin et libam la'aviyam shebashamayim, hayu mitgabrim. This is not a miracle at all. When Moshe is up there and the Jewish people are obviously looking to him, he's their leader, when his hands are lifted up, their gaze is lifted up to their Father in heaven in prayer. And when Moshe's hands are down, their gaze goes down, and they are not praying. And as they are pouring their hearts out to Hashem, they have the strength to prevail. And when they are not davening, they don't. How do we know? How do we know this is not just drush? How do we know this is true? How do we know that the incident with Moshe's hands is not really supernatural and determining the outcome of the battle? Well, we know because the Torah tells us so very explicitly in the next pasuk. It says, "Vayachalosh Yehoshua et Amalek ve'et Amo lefi charev." It was Yehoshua and his army, the Torah says, not Moshe and his hands, that weakened Amalek. And they achieved this victory, lefi charev, by the sword, through the natural means of warfare. The battle was won by an army fighting al pi teva, fighting according to the laws of the natural world. It was a real victory by a real world army, But at the same time, the Torah makes it clear that this victory is not kochi va'otzem yadi, just my hand and my strength and my might triumphing. It was a real world victory, but it was a real world victory by an army of God-fearing men representing a nation that was engaged in fasting and prayer, its gaze turned ever upward to the heavens. This battle was a learning experience for Bnei Israel, not only then, but through eternity, for us too, teaching us that in the world of Teva, in the world of nature, Hashem's Hashgacha may not be obvious, but it is ever present. When danger, here in the form of war, strikes, man must do his hishtadlus. He must fight by the sword, but always accompanied by faith and prayer and fasting and fear of God. So we have seen that the defining characteristic of Amalek is denial of God's active presence in the world. Amalek explained away even revealed miracles and attributed them to coincidence. And in Gematria, it's interesting that the name Amalek equals 240, which is exactly the same as the word Safek, doubt. Because Amalek's mission is to sow doubt about God's providence in the world. This kind of willful skepticism is rampant, certainly in the world around us. Rav Dessler writes in Michtam Eliyahu that even Nisim Gluyim, even revealed miracles, are compelling only to one who is a believer. One who chooses not to believe will always find ways to dismiss even obvious miracles by explaining them rationally as being part of the natural order. The Ramban, in a very famous Ramban at the end of Parshat Bo, you have it here in source 16, says that by contrast, faith in Hashem's Hashkacha, faith in divine providence, is a fundamental principle of the Jewish faith. The Ramban says, "Umin ha-nisim ha-gdolim ha-mefursamim, adam modeh ba-nisim ha-nistarim shehem yisod ha-Torah kula." From witnessing revealed miracles, a person comes to appreciate and acknowledge the hidden miracles that are the foundation of the entire Torah. She'en la'adam chelek b'Torat Moshe Rabbeinu ad she'na'amin b'chol dvareinu u'mikreinu she'kulam nisim. Ein bahem teva u'minhago shel olam, bein barabim, bein biyachid. A person has no chelek in the Torah of Moshe Rabbeinu until we believe that everything that happens to us is really miraculous and cannot be attributed to the natural order or to the way of the world. And this is as true of the individual as it is of the klal. Well, now that we have established that the conflict between Amalek and Klal Yisrael is rooted in two antithetical worldviews, one which sees coincidence where the other sees the purposeful hand of God, let us trace the history of this conflict as it appears throughout the Sifrei Kodesh. There are three major encounters with Amalek that are described in Tanakh, one in Chumash, one in Nevi'im, and one in Ketuvim. The first of these we have already analyzed in Chumash. The second is Shaul's battle against Agag in Sefer Shmuel Aleph. And the third is the saga that we read just this past Thursday in Megillat Esther. It's well known that Hashem's name does not appear in Megillat Esther because the Purim story is the quintessence of Hester Panim, Hashem operating from behind the curtain. The whole story of Purim unfolds through a series of elaborate coincidences that are so intricate and so improbable that one cannot help but conclude that this could not possibly have happened by chance. Esther's name is from the same root as Hester, hidden. And the word Megillah is from the root Gilui, revelation. So the very name of the Sefer, Megillat Esther, hints to us that the purpose of this Sefer is to reveal the hidden hand of Hashem. And just as the coincidences in the Purim story are so fantastic that they lead us to an appreciation of the hidden hand of Hashem, so too I would argue that the entire history of the relationship between Amalek and Klal Yisrael is so replete with improbable coincidences that it gives the lie to the very premise of Amalek. The first mention of Amalek in Tanakh is not actually in Parshas Beshalach. It is in Sefer Bereshis, Parshas Vayishlach, and that's source 11 on your sheet, where we learn that Amalek, who was Amalek? Amalek was the son of Eliphaz, who was the son of Esav. Amalek was the grandson of Esav. So suddenly it becomes clear.
Don't trust your relatives.
So suddenly it becomes clear to us that the conflict between Bnei Yisrael and Amalek in the desert did not begin there. This incident that is described in Bishalach and in Kitetze is really the continuation of an old and painful family feud. The struggle between Yaakov and Esav, the ancestors of Klal Yisrael and Amalek, was also the result of two competing worldviews. Yaakov was Ish HaEmes, who clearly saw the Yad Hashem in every aspect of his life and in everything in the world, while Esav was the personification of Kochi Va'otzem Yadi Asali Et HaChayel Hazeh, that everything that happens is a function of my power, my strength, the strength of my hand. It's axiomatic that Esav sonel Yaakov. Esav had an enduring hatred for Yaakov that was perpetuated by his descendants. In Parshas Toldos, the Torah, and here this is source number 12, tells us, "Vayistom Esav et Yaakov al habchora asher becho aviv, vayomer Esav belibo, yikruvu yimei evel aviv, v'ahargah et Yaakov achi." Esav hated Yaakov and vowed to kill him, to murder him. And Rashi, in source 13, cites a midrash that Eliphaz was instructed by his father Esav to pursue Yaakov and to kill him. And Eliphaz did indeed pursue Yaakov, but when he caught up with him, because his grandfather Yitzchak Avinu had had such a profound influence in his upbringing, he could not bring himself to kill his uncle. The climactic encounter between Yaakov and Esav takes place in Parshas Bishalach, that's source 14. This is immediately following Yaakov's transformative encounter with the Malach Hashem, as a result of which his name is changed to Yisrael. Yaakov fears that Esav may attack him and his family, and he prepares for battle. He does his hishtadlus, but at the same time, he hopes to find a way to avoid going to war with Esav. And as Esav appears, Yaakov and his wives and all of his children bow down to him repeatedly, and Esav is placated, and war is averted. Now, it's an interesting coincidence that all of Yaakov's sons bow down to Esav, with the exception of Binyamin, who was not yet born. The next encounter between the descendants of Yaakov and the descendants of Esav is when Amalek attacks Bnei Israel in the desert on their way to Matan Torah. And it is as a result of this encounter that Hashem Kavyachol declares a perpetual state of war with Amalek. Let's go back to the Ramban in source 3. The Ramban, in his commentary on that enigmatic pasuk, Yad al Kiska, if we go to the middle underlined section, says, V'yesh mefarshim ki kasher tiyah yad al kisei Hashem tiyah milchama l'Hashem ba'amalek, v'chein tiyah midor l'dor, v'hainyan ki kasher Hashem kasher yiyah melech b'Yisrael, Yoshev al kisei Hashem yilachem ba'amalek, v'hu remez l'shal ha'melech harishon. He cites the opinion that the mitzvah to fight Amalek is relevant when there is a king in Israel, and that this is an allusion to Shaul HaMelech, the first king of Israel. In Sefer Shmuel Aleph Perek Tesvav, which we read as the Haftorah on Parshas Zachor, on the Shabbos before Purim, the Navi Shmuel comes to Shaul HaMelech, and this is in source number 17, and commands him to go to war against Amalek and to destroy without pity every man, woman, and child and all of their livestock. Now, who is Shaul HaMelech? When he was anointed, we learned his lineage. He was the son of Kish, and he is from the Shevet of Binyamin. Remember, it was Binyamin who was the only one of Yaakov Avinu's sons who never bowed down to Esav. How coincidental, or providential, that it is a descendant of Binyamin who must do battle against Esav's descendant, Amalek. Shaul complies, and he does, in fact, wipe out the entire nation of Amalek. But he deviates from Hashem's command in three critical ways. Details. Number one, he spares the life of Agag, the king of Amalek. Number two, he ignores the prohibition against taking spoils of war, and he allows the people to take the choicest livestock of Amalek. And number three, he builds a monument. And as a consequence of these failings, he loses his kingship. And it is Shmuel HaNavi who does what Shaul failed to do. He slays Agag, saying in very chilling words in Pasuk Lamed Gimel in Source 17, Vayomer Shmuel, Ka'asher shikla nashim charbecha, ken tishkal mi nashim imecha. As your sword has made women childless, so too your mother shall become childless. And he slays Agag. This is a midah keneged midah. Now, Shaul's failure to completely fulfill Hashem's command reverberates far into Jewish history. Approximately 400 years later, in Persia, the Jewish people faced the threat of annihilation at the hands of the Hitler of the ancient world, Haman HaAgagi. Wait a minute. How could Haman have been a descendant of Agag? If Agag was slain by Shmuel HaNavi, and the entire rest of Amalek had been killed by Shaul. So Chazal say that when Agag was captured, he recognized that his nation had been decimated, and he was desperate to revive his people. And in the brief interim between his capture by Shaul and his being put to death at the hands of Shmuel HaNavi, he managed to father a child. And that child became the ancestor of a reborn Amalek nation and of Haman HaAgagi. So Shaul's misplaced compassion for Agag inadvertently led to near catastrophe for the Jewish people. So the conflict at the heart of Megillat Esther turns out to be a sequel to the confrontation between Shaul and Agag 400 years earlier. And when Mordechai is introduced to us in Perek Beit of Megillat Esther, the Megillat tells us, Ishu di ayah b'shushan habira u'shmor Mordechai ben Yair ben Shim'i ben Kish ishimini. Who was Mordechai? He was from Shevet Binyamin. And what is one of the first things that we learn about him? V'chol avdei ha-melech asher b'shar ha-melech kor'im u'mishtachavim la-haman ki'chein tziva lo ha-melech. All of the courtiers in Ahasuerus's court are bowing down to Haman because that's what the king commanded. U'mordechai lo yichra v'lo yishtachaveh. But only Mordechai will not bend his knee and will not bow down. Rav Dessler in Michta Me'eliyahu, and this is source 19, cites the commentary of the Maharal, who asks, how could Mordechai justify this kind of open defiance of Haman when he knew that he was endangering the entire Jewish people? Mordechai's contemporaries chided him for his extreme behavior, and they said to him, why do you have to be such a fanatic? Why do you have to be so unyielding? After all, our own ancestors, Yaakov Avinu and the Shiftei Ka, bowed down to Esav in order to spare the Jewish people. And Rav Dessler explains that Mordechai's response to his critics was to say, I am from Shevet Binyamin. Your forefathers bowed down to Esav, but my forefather did not. And hence the pasuk ulevinyamin amar yudid Hashem yishkon lavetach uven ktefav shachem. It is because Binyamin did not bow down to Esav that he merited to have the Beis Hamikdash, the Shechina, in his nachala, in his portion. And as a result, the descendants of Binyamin had a special legacy that was imprinted, if you will, in their spiritual DNA. They were endowed with a constitutional inability to compromise with evil, and also with an extra measure of absolute bitachon, which is what, because one needs nerves of steel if one is going to face the lion, stare the lion down like that. Mordechai had absolute bitachon that Hashem would save the Jewish people. Now Mordechai is not merely a descendant of Binyamin. The pasuk tells us that he is a descendant of Kish, which tells us that he is from the precise same family lineage as Shaul HaMelech. And indeed the Chida says that Mordechai's tafkid, Mordechai's mission was to be a tikkun, a correction for Shaul. So where Shaul wavered and had mercy on Agag, Mordechai is unyielding in the face of Agag's descendant, Haman. And although the Jews of Persia were expressly permitted to take the spoils of war when they went to war to save themselves, the Megillah says that they were expressly permitted to do that, the Megillah also takes pains to tell us, uvaviza lo shalchu et yadam, that they did not touch anything. And this, of course, is a tikkun, a correction, for the Jews of Shaul HaMelech's kingdom who took the spoils when they were forbidden to do so. So in case you ever wondered, as I often have, why it is that this pasuk of Mordechai's lineage is one of four psukim in the Megillah that we say out loud, it should now be clear that Mordechai's lineage is not a minor detail. In fact, it is one of the main points of the Megillah, because it establishes that the Purim story is not an isolated random incident. It is an event that was connected to the past, and by implication, connected to the future. It is an event that is embedded in the mighty stream of Jewish history. And it is a reminder to us that nothing happens by chance. There was unfinished business since the time of Shaul HaMelech. And this was the time to rectify it. It had to be rectified. The divine providence that led to the salvation of the Jews of Shushan is meant to serve for us as a paradigm of Hashem's ongoing relationship with the Jews during Galut. Long after the events of Purim, the Megillah demonstrates the permanence of our connection with Hashem, despite generations and generations of Hester Panim. Rav Dessler writes in Source 20 that in our world, in the real world, Hashem's Hashkacha is benistar, it's hidden. But we do have opportunities to witness what he calls the Galui Shebenistar, to reveal the hidden. And that we see most clearly in Megillat Esther. Rav Dessler writes that there are times in every person's life when a person can identify a sequence of events that may appear to be coincidental and unrelated. And there may be layer upon layer of plausible causes and explanations, and each event may appear to be completely independent of the others. But when one can step back and see the picture, one recognizes that everything fits together perfectly, and all the seemingly unconnected events lead to one specific outcome. And at such times, Rav Dessler says, even the most rational person has to suspend rationality, if you will, and admit that the only rational conclusion is that there is a hidden providential hand. And at that moment, he says, one is overcome by a sense of wonder and awe, and one can appreciate that we do witness miracles all the time, and that each of us can see the Yad Hashem in our lives. So in this context, I think it's interesting to note that the Sfas Emes says that the midah of Amalek, the defining trait of Amalek, is shichacha, forgetting. And in contrast to that, the midah of the Jewish people is zechira, remembrance. We have many examples of this. Zechor et yom ha-shabbat l'kadsho, zechor et asher asa lecha Amalek, zecher l'tziat Mitzrayim, zechor yemot olam. We are a people who remember. A person who has no memory lives entirely in the present moment. He has no perspective of past or future. And without memory, there can be no sense of hakaras hatov, no sense of gratitude, no sense of continuity with the past, no sense of responsibility to the future. With a mindset like that, it's impossible to discern Hashem's hashgacha in the world. It's impossible to feel bound by the ethical principles that flow from an appreciation of the sacred. Only a people who value and cultivate memory can discern the long sequence of seemingly unrelated events that cumulatively reveal the presence of Hashem's hashgacha in the world. So I'd like to end by coming full circle. We referred earlier to the parish of the Kli Yakar, who noted that the place name Rifidim contains the same letters as the word Rafu, weakened, they became weakened in their connection to Hashem, and as the word Pirut, separation, factionalism. And the Kli Yakar said that Bnei Yisrael in the Midbar became vulnerable to attack by Amalek because their faith in Hashem was weakened and because they became distant from each other. And if we ask, as many of the Mefarshim do, why did the Jewish people become vulnerable to Haman's destructive decree so many generations later, we find that the same essential answer applies. The Jews of Persia are criticized for participating in Ahasuerus's lewd banquet. They were becoming assimilated. They were becoming distanced from Hashem's Torah. And when Haman seeks to persuade Ahasuerus to destroy the Jews, what does he say about them? Yeshno am echad mefuzar u'meforad. There is a people in your kingdom who are dispersed and meforad. Meforad, from the same root as pirud. They are divided. They are disunited. In each case, at Rifidim in the Chumash and in Persia at the time of Purim, Klal Yisrael have become distanced from Hashem and distanced from each other. In each case, they face a mortal threat. And in each case, they are saved through a series of events that appear on the surface to be entirely al-piteva, natural, rational, coincidental, if you will. They are required to act and to take responsibility for themselves. They have to go to war. But in both cases, when it's all over, they are able to perceive the divine providence that was the true source of their salvation. The result in both cases is that they emerge from their ordeal with their faith in Hashem and with their sense of brotherhood with each other vastly strengthened. And this outcome is quite clearly reflected in the text and in the Mefarshim. The Megillah ends with the victory of the Jews over their enemies, and with the statement "Kimu v'kiblu ha'Yehudim," the Jews fulfilled and accepted and took upon themselves. And Chazal explained "Kimu az mashakiblu kvar." They accepted upon themselves at Purim what they had taken upon themselves before at Matan Torah. This is a reaffirmation of Kabbalas HaTorah, of Kabbalas Ol Malchus Shamayim. And how is it commemorated? By declaring a Yom Tov to be celebrated with Mishloach Manot Ish L'Reyehu U'Matanot Le'Avyonim, celebrated by giving gifts to one's fellow man and by caring for the poor and the vulnerable in their midst. And if we go back to the original conflict with Amalek in the desert, the Torah tells us what happens immediately after this incident when the war is over. Vayis'u mirifidim vayavo midbar Sinai. Having learned experientially that Hashem's hashgacha was with them even in the world of Teva, they are ready to leave Rifidim and all that it symbolizes behind, and to journey to Horev, to journey to Sinai, to experience the divine revelation and the ultimate Devekut Bahashem at Mamad Har Sinai. When they encamped at Rifidim, they were a people without unity. And therefore the Torah says, Vayachanu b'Rifidim, Vayachanu, they encamped in the plural form. But when they arrive at Midbar Sinai to receive the Torah, the Pasuk says, Vayichan Sham Yisrael Keneged Ha'har. Vayichan in the singular. And Rashi very famously explains in the singular, Ki Ish Echad Belev Echad. They were like one man with one heart. So the message of Purim, I think, is clear, and it is as relevant to us today as it ever was. When we allow ourselves to see the divine providence in our own lives and to appreciate Hashem's miracles, which are with us every day, our faith in Hashem is strengthened, and so is our connection to each other. And in this way, we will be'ezrat Hashem merit the final redemption b'mehera b'yameinu. Thank you. If anybody has any questions, I'm happy to take questions. No questions? Okay. Yeah.
What do you make of our current, first of all, inability to identify who Amalek is, and my discomfort with the idea of the commandment of genocide of another nation, of every person, babies, right? That's what it says in the Torah about Amalek.
No, that's not what it says in the Torah about Amalek. It doesn't say that. It doesn't say that. It says that by Shaul. That was a specific command that was given to Shaul. It does not say that in the Torah. There's many differences of opinion about that. It's true, the Sefer HaChinuch says that it is exactly what you said, and that it's a mitzvah that's incumbent upon every single Jewish person in relation to every Amaleki person at any time, in any place. If you're walking down the street and you can identify someone as Amalek, that you're supposed to kill them. That is the position of the Chinuch. But there are many other interpretations. The Ramban, as we saw, said that it applies to, it's a mitzvah incumbent upon the nation as a whole. When they're settled in Eretz Yisrael and they have a king, the Rambam takes the position that the mitzvah is applicable also in Eretz Yisrael, only in a time of war when we're being attacked. And he says, even then, even with Amalek, as with other enemies, first there has to be a korei l'shalom. The Jewish people have to offer a peaceful settlement to Amalek. They have to offer to them, meaning that the enemy has to agree to make peace and to abide by the Shiva Mitzvot B'nei Noach and to pay taxes, it says, according to some interpretations. And if Amalek agrees to do that, then you're not allowed to kill them. So it's a far cry from genocide in the conventional sense of the word. I'm sorry, I can't remember the first part of your question.
Oh, well, the idea that in our world we can't identify.
Yeah, so the Rambam also says that that ever since Sancheriv came and mixed up the nations, we don't know who is genetically Mizera Amalek. I could have given a whole shiur just on that question. There's a lot that can be said about that. Rav Salvechik takes the position that in Kol Dor Didofek, he says that he holds that any enemy of the Jewish people where you can discern that it's also really from these kinds of motivations and that it's really as much a war against what God represents is really considered ke'ilu their Amalek. People write about that extensively, about did he mean that literally or does he mean that figuratively? Far be it from me to have any comment on that. There are sources apparently in the Gemara. I haven't seen this myself, but I've been told that there are sources in the Gemara that imply that there's a basis in which to see that the Nazis in Germany could be defined as Mizera Amalek, and certainly it's attributed to Weissmandel, and also I think maybe the Belzer Rebbe that they saw a hint to Nazi Germany in Megillat Esther. So there's a lot, you know, there's a wealth of stuff that's been said and written on the question, but it's really a very, very complicated question. I'm trying to give you just a very short and quick answer. Yeah?
I just wanted to take your point, Rabbi Soloveitchik, one step further. Rabbi Soloveitchik, one of his principles is that being a true Halachic Jew isn't always very comfortable, and he talks about the fact that part of it is this ongoing discomfort or conflict with your own personal feelings. And his conclusion is that this is why we have the mitzvah of Mechiyat Amalek, and why we have to remember, because not everything that we're commanded to do is always comfortable with our humane aspect, and that part of being a Torah-abiding Jew is doing things that don't always make sense to you, but because we are commanded by Hashem.
And it's pretty clear from the story with Shaul HaMelech, because he takes pity on Agag, and the consequence of that is near destruction of the Jewish people 400 years later.
From your sources, I saw that maybe Kibaki was that the Rim, that the reason why in Devarim the Israel are commanded with the wiping out of Amalek is that before they go into Eretz Yisrael and actually culminate becoming a people, that's when it becomes their mitzvah of the wiping out of Amalek and actually executing what Hashem wants to do, which is what was in Sefer Shemot.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Thank you. Anybody else? Thank you all very much.
Thank you very, very, very much for your words of Torah. I want to thank all of our wonderful sponsors, without whom we could not have Midrash Yom Rishon. We will have a more complete list for you next month. And stay tuned for the date and speaker for Midrash Yom Rishon next month, which will be at some point after Pesach. Thank you.
I'm going to go to the next one. But my only question is, you should see the communication that go on the schedule. It's like, but you know, the truth is,
you got two double doses of bacon.
so beautiful. I wouldn't be surprised if he'll be left there at the chef. He's looking at this in a very different lens.
Oh good. I'm so glad. There's so much there. I want you to know, I could have done twice as long. I've been the whole last 3 days cutting. You know, there's so much. It's so rich.
It's been going on for a few weeks.
The deeper you go, the more impassable that is.
Exactly.
Because when you see the connections from one safer to another, and from one kufa to another, how could it be?
Directly repeating whatever this person wrote.
Oh,
saying.
Good. Good. I'm just glad to hear that.
The dinner was so good.